Text is, you could ask. So I'll start, and what I hope is not too self-serving a way, just describing the program I teach in and the way we do things and what I've seen and experienced about leading small group discussions in a particular way. So let me start by saying we call it Socratic, but if you've read Plato's dialogues and seen how Socrates acts, we don't act like that. Like pure Socratic would be a kind of badgering or hectoring, you know, driven kind of a style. The way the word Socratic gets used more broadly has more to do with launching an inquiry that you pursue in a small group setting. So a couple things that are different from, if there's such a thing as pure Socratic, it would be one person really driving the conversation through questions. And a fairly small group, like how many people are really participating in a classic Socratic dialogue in Plato? Like four, maybe? Possibly there are seven people gathered around in the House of Cephalus in the opening book of Republic, but most of them aren't talking. Like once Thrasymachus starts shouting, it's just him for a while, right? And then a couple people step in. Whereas we're going for 16, our group size in the Torrey Honors College at Biola is about 16 students. It may drift down to 13 when we get attrition in the upper years. It may balloon up to 18 or 19 when something goes wrong and people have to transfer from one group to another. And it sounds super spoiled to say this, but 19 is too many. I mean, but that's only because we're looking for genuine active learning at all times. So I had someone observe one of my classes a couple weeks ago. There's a new vice president higher up in the admin at Biola and didn't know anything about what we did in Torrey Honors, so wanted to come see it. Popped in for 1 hour, and I set it up carefully, but then I also got lucky, and it just, when he was there, almost like 12 of the 16 students talked, and I think I said one thing just to correct one little minor thing that somebody had said. So it was, on the one hand, this new boss didn't get to see me at work. He saw me showing no skills, discernibly, right? But that's fine, because what he saw was what we're trying to do. The dream class is you ask a question and students take off, and they discuss it amongst themselves, but in a progressive kind of linear way. They're actually pursuing a thought. They're not just taking turns saying, well, here's what I got out of it, well, here's what I got out of it. They're actually, a project has been proposed, they get it, they've got ideas for how to attack it, and they go after it. So that's the dream class. Like the Platonic ideal of the dream class would be the tutor talks for the first 2 minutes, and then the students speak for the rest of the time, and it comes to a wonderful, satisfying conclusion about 3 hours later. That almost never happens, though I've seen something close. I don't think I've led anything very close to that, but I've seen other tutors do it. There are other tutors on the faculty who have a very elegant economic leadership style that I don't have. But I can talk about individual styles here in a minute. Here's what it takes to get that kind of an active learning conversation going. And again, in Q&A, we can talk about other groups where it might work. But what we've got is a group of 16 students. They are bound to each other by being in a cohort or a small group that we put them in as freshmen, and they are in for the whole 4 years. In Torrey. And that's going to be about 55 units. So that's going to be, you know, the equivalent of that many courses. Now, they may need to leave that group if their major, everyone's in a different major. This is just the gen ed. This is just the general education component of their college experience. So they've got music majors, business majors, all kinds of STEM majors, lots of film majors and business. I think it's a business already, right? If they have a non-negotiable major class that conflicts with their group schedule in Torrey, they'll have to go to another group for that semester. But otherwise, unless something like that intervenes, they're with that group, like that circle of 16 people. And then we give them a name, like, you are, welcome in, new freshman, you are the Calvin group. Go be Calvin, right? Or you're the Lewis group, or whatever. And they identify with that. We invest in an orientation week. We have them show up 3 days before the rest of the freshmen, like no one on campus but the athletes and the first generation students who need some special support, and the Torrey people who are getting 3 days of orientation, which we call Torrientation. Pretty clever, I know. And that orientation is run by our upperclassmen. So the students in the program bring in the new students and make sure they get the ethos of it. Mainly that has to do with it convincing them that we actually do read books, right? Like often nothing has prepared them for the fact that like we're actually reading. We're not pretending to read it. We're really reading it. But on the discussion side, they're also trying to get them geared into the fact that this is going to be on them to do the learning. So there's that orientation. We do that partly by lecture. We lecture them about not getting lectured at. So I know there's a performative inconsistency there. But we do that partly, really just present the facts to them. And then we also give them a practice session. We have a special name for that. We have made special names for lots of things because we're always trying to kind of ride that line where it feels just unique enough to require some special naming, but not quite feel like a cult. Right? But like you definitely know you're in it. A lot of our sharpest freshmen, if you ask them, how are you getting your general education? They'll actually get a really dumb look on their face and say, what? Well, I don't know what general education is. What do you mean? I'm just in Tory. It's like, oh, good. We have stamped you and branded you with the idea that there's a thing called Tory. It's like, well, that's cool for me. 30 years ago, there wasn't a thing called Tory. We just invented it and named it after R.A. Tory. So they get that. And then for the rest of their experience, this is, I think, crucial to getting the active learning thing going. They have their schedule. They have their book list. They know that they're going to read through this books in this sequence over the course of 4 years. And they're going to do it with these 16 people, which has a name. You know, it's like, oh, it's the Augustine group. And then they know there's going to be a professional in the room with them every time they meet. One of the 16 faculty that teach in the Honors College will be there to lead the discussion. In session, we call ourselves tutors. In office hours, we call ourselves mentors, but that's to flag the different roles we're playing, right? Like in session, Homer's Iliad is the teacher. The Iliad, the text, runs the discussion. The tutor just proctors it to make sure that Homer has his way. You know, so the fact that they don't know who their tutor is going to be is really huge. So like, not only do they not have someone guiding them over the course of a semester, they really don't know until the minute you walk in who's going to be there. It's a simple trick, but if you can pull it off, it's magic. I know there's very few social situations. I'm describing how we do it to sort of be at the size we are. 16 faculty, 400 students, 55 unit footprint. It's an educational endeavor of a certain industrial size, you know, but it's really kind of magical. Because you're not there for them, they go through this little tiny crisis of abandonment and then they deal with it, right? Like, okay, it's just us. Like, we're in charge. The Calvin group has to know how to get through all of these books. And they take ownership of that pretty quickly. And then, of course, they're thrilled when you walk through the door into the room and they realize, oh, good. You've got the opening question. You've got a plan. You've been thinking about this. You have probably even been conferring with our tutors in the previous sessions about how we're doing and what to do. But there's just something magical about the fact that they are on their own resources. They're doing the discussion. Let's see. I could say more about that, but I want to talk about the active learning thing. So quick dichotomy between active learning and passive learning. I would prefer personally to say receptive learning, but let's say passive. What it means is you're listening. The teacher is an authority or a knowledge source and is giving you the information. You are intelligently, but non-actively, like receiving the information and retaining it. I love passive learning. I was a pretty good student later in my academic life, and I can receive instruction from a knowledgeable person. It's great. They know things you don't know. If they thought well about how to put it together, they put together this great lecture, which kind of on the old German model, lecture meant something like they had read everything and now they were going to tell you about it. You know, it's wonderful. Before I went to seminary here at Asbury Seminary, I had a year off kind of working for a living and doing independent reading. Just read stacks of books for fun in an unguided, undisciplined way, just whatever looked like cool theology, I read it. Then I went to seminary, and my first New Testament class was taught by a librarian who was famously had unrealistic standards for what everyone in the universe should read, right? So he would just go lecturing through a topic and say, like, well, you better read this before you get out of here. You better read this. It wasn't assigned. He would just tell you, like, these are the books you should read. Well, in like 3/4 of the cases, I had read the book but had no idea how to situate it in a larger discourse. So when this librarian started telling me, here's where this fits in the discourse, I was like, oh my gosh. I was having one of these learning moments that's not linear. You know, usually you're learning like precept on precept. Now I know this, now I know this. This was like a wall of integrated knowledge was hitting me. I'm like, yes, that's a brilliant lecture. And I happened to be primed to receive it really well, but passively. I wasn't making a noise. I was writing like crazy and my synapses were firing. It was wonderful. I love passive learning. A lot of people who teach in my program and are invested in Socratic active learning will put down passive learning. They'll use the word regurgitate every time they use the word lecture, right? And I call them and I say, it's kind of a cliche, isn't it? Like, people aren't literally regurgitating, I hope. They're not just like passively taking in information so they can spit it back out on the test. That's actually, you're talking about knowledge transfer and acquisition. That's good stuff. We just don't do it in our program because it doesn't mix well with active learning, right? These are two different modes. So it's one thing to receive information, and it's another thing to do the work of making the connections and finding stuff for yourself in a group. So the fact that they don't mix means, in my program, it means we never lecture in session. We give special lectures in the evening at 7:30, which is a non-session time. Students have to attend a certain number of lectures at their discretion. They have to pick from the menu one lecture for each unit they're registered for. It may have no connection to what happened in session. Session's a no lecture time. The reason is you just can't combine listening to a lecture and actively discussing. It won't work. And this is a mistake people make in a lot of contexts. What they'll think is, I want to engineer the joy of discovery for people. I want them to do the work of seeing the things and learning and making the connections. But I also want enough control to guarantee some quality and give some real direction to this. And so they'll start with a mini lecture and then open things up to discussion. It is very difficult to get a group of students to upshift from passive learning to active learning. I'm not sure I've ever seen it. You might take a break and do jumping jacks or something. You might pass around snacks. You might do something like physically breaks them out of lecture mode. But short of that, they're just not gonna do it. So if you need to combine them for some reason, start with active learning and then do lecturing as cleanup. You know, like I noticed as you were discussing that you were totally wrong about something. Let me inform you about that. There is objective truth. This is not anything goes. It's just active learning guided by a text. Again, our institutional solution is to strongly separate when they're doing session from when they're receiving lectures. The lectures we used to call context lectures, and sometimes they're like background and information and even some interpretive moves with reference to a text. Though I have friends who teach at Thomas Aquinas College in California, which is a Roman Catholic, great books, Socratic school, does a lot of things very similar to us, except their tutors follow the students through the whole arc of a course, so they're with them the whole time, and they never lecture, period. So they're actually scandalized. Thomas Aquinas tutors are scandalized that we would actually stand in front of a room and declare in sentences what we believe and what we think is going on. They think like, well, once you've done that, you've removed the Socratic veil. It's over. You can never again be truly Socratic. Students know what you think. And so we conservative Protestant evangelicals who sign a doctrinal statement every year say to our Roman Catholic friends, I'm pretty sure they know what we think. Like, I'm pretty sure you read the great books and it all turns out, come home to Rome, the Pope is right. And I'm pretty sure we read the great books Socratically, and it means this other thing about being conservative evangelical. So, like, there's a question of, like, what the Socratic veil is actually doing. We're also really clear about, in office hours, as university professors at Biola University, we're much more likely to tell you directly what you think. In fact, you can kind of get this working back and forth by saying, I will lead a disturbing class about faith and work in Galatians. It'll be, like, Socratically edgy. Students will be freaking out in the second hour, like, but how can this be? What's going on here? I can raise in a question the issue of legalism and make them think, like, maybe I didn't even know that was a word, but maybe I am one. And then I can immediately leave class and load up a bunch of office hours the next day and just watch it go pop, 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 pop. Because I know the students who got most disturbed about that are going to show up in office hours and ask, like, what were you driving at? In our pedagogy, it's fine to tell them what you were driving at in office hours. It's the fact of actually being at a different time, at a different place, and being honest and open about what you believe. But but keeping the Socratic zone itself, that three-hour conversation, I don't care if it seems like it's going crazy. I don't care if they think I'm an anti-Trinitarian. I don't care if they feel like their faith is eroding under their feet. Now, in all other senses, I do care because I want to build up their faith. The goal of our instruction is actually knowledge, and it matters a lot to me what I confess and believe and teach. But the Socratic session is trying to get at all those goals in not the direct passive learning way. So that's how we handle that. When was the last time I did? I took a group of students through Calvin's Institutes, our third session on it. We do three sessions on the Institutes. And we were doing the doctrine of baptism. And I taught on baptism, and I taught Calvin's view on baptism. When I say I taught, I mean I asked questions about what does he mean by that? Why does he say that? Student would give an answer. I would say, how does that relate to this other thing? So the result is Calvin's teaching on baptism really ran the class, and a bunch of them kind of freaked out because they were raised Christian but not baptized, and here they were 19 years old in college thinking, like, now what? Like, does Calvin think I'm not a Christian? And so it got kind of hot. And in particular, that session I run in a particular way. We do 90 minutes of careful, hard reading of Calvin, getting his distinctions right, understanding how he's arguing this and why, seeing why he says things the way he does. Then we take a little break and go around the circle and do baptism stories. Hey, tell me your baptism story. Because from years in church ministry, I've realized everybody's got a complex baptism story. Mine's very complex. I don't know. I was raised by some real pagans who were not anywhere near churches. And as they would say, if I went to church, the roof would cave in. That's like our family's way of saying that. But there's a photo of me in a long white kind of a baby gown thing being held in the front of a church with a cross displayed in the background. And I'm thinking, what is that? You people were not in church that whole decade. Why do you have a picture of me in front of a church? And my mom said, oh, it's your christening. I said, qu'est-ce que c'est, christening? This is not a word we use in my tradition. I'm like, what is that? So I asked everyone I knew, like, do you reckon I was baptized? And they said, well, what do you mean by that? I said, well, did I get wet and the name of the Trinity was spoken near me, like in front of people? Like, that, you know. Anyway, I had to decide about that. Like, should I seek baptism? Should I not seek baptism once I become Christian? Everyone's got a complicated story. So we go around the circle. Everyone tells their story. Then we go back into the text. The result is, I think, of the 16 students in that sophomore group, I think six of them got baptized that year. And they populated my office hours the next day with, like, am I in trouble? If I die now, am I going to hell? I'm like, no, settle down. Of course not. Like, should I get baptized? Oh, yeah, obviously. Like, you know? And I was just telling them what I thought. So you could say I was using Calvin to make my point. You could also say Calvin was running that session and I was doing damage control afterwards. But that's kind of like the... That's the whole package. We have the liberty we have the freedom to set up different settings like that in which to reach the different aims of our teaching. But the Socratic session itself has to be pretty sacrosanct so that if a student asks me in class, what should I do about this? What's going on? What do you think? I'm actually going to retreat behind the veil. The Socratic veil is good for that. In the great books tradition in American higher ed, the Socratic method of mainly asking questions has kept people from being like gurus or overly dominating their students. There's the great books tradition in American education is only about 150 years old. Well, it's really only about 100 years old if we're talking about what started at Columbia and went through the University of Chicago, like that thread. It has tended to lead to guruism or an older intellect overly dominating young minds. And I think the reason for that is the kind of people who get attracted to it tend to be sort of, I don't know how to characterize them charitably. They tend to be sort of expansive thinkers who really like to see sort of minds catch fire in the presence of great ideas. And if they're salesmen at all, they're like driving a point. The other thing is, if you go through this education process and you're reading like Plato and Aristotle and Dante and Shakespeare and Jane Austen, and you're reading all these amazing things, and one guiding intellect is kind of like taking you through it all, you can tend to sort of idolize that great mind. And whenever that great mind does reveal any little hint of where to go or what to think or how to connect the dots, you might fall enthralled to it. That's been a besetting problem of great books education, and that's why it looks cultic from the outside to a lot of people. Responsible practitioners of Great Books Education are aware of this and try to undercut it in various ways. At Thomas Aquinas College, Columbia, back in the 40s, they had two tutors in the room at all times. And that does an amazing thing to the older mind that wants to dominate younger minds unfairly. Having another older mind in the room to take pot shots at them turns out to work really well. You need funding for that because you're double teaching. We don't have that funding, so what we do is we team teach everything asynchronously. So there's a different tutor in the room every time. So if I'm doing Republic 1, someone else is going to follow me on Republic 2, and they're going to, if the students say back to them something that is, you know, not accurate or is tilted in a certain way, they can, without making fun of me, undercut the absoluteness with which I may have impressed that idea on students by questioning. So that undercuts that tendency to guruism. The other great thing about Socratic questioning is, if you're functioning in tutor mode, it means that you can use the same technique, which is to ask questions, questioning technique, you can use the same technique to keep yourself from over-determining the class if you know too much about the book, and it can also help you hide your ignorance if you know too little about the book. The same exact tool does both things equally well. So I'm an expert in Trinitarian theology. We read Gregory Nazianzus' 5 Theological Orations. When a hard question comes up in that book, without even opening the book, I'm thinking, well, in Greek it says as follows, and Maximus the Confessor described it this way, but John of Damascus corrected him this way, and Aquinas synthesized it in the following way. And that's just all in my mind, because it's my field, right? But then I'm teaching the Federalist Papers, and I haven't read all the Federalist Papers, right? Just the assigned ones. So when a question comes up where a student's got a real interpretive crux, I'm like, the lazy version is, what do you think it means, right? But you can work a little harder at a question, obviously. But in both cases, in one case, I'm trying to not take over with my expert knowledge in a field. In another case, I'm trying to lead a valuable, truly educational, progressive reading of the text that really makes progress in understanding, even though I am lightly armed and cannot remember where to go next or actually don't know. So it's a valuable tool. Let me talk about two kinds of questions. We use, and I recommend using in whatever institutional setting this will work for you, an opening question and then follow-up questions. The opening question we put a ton of energy into. This is the main way you plan for a class and know you're prepped. If you're just giving a lecture, you can just write the lecture and then give it. It's easy to know when you're done. If you're planning for a 3-hour class on Shakespeare, on Hamlet, let's say, you never quite know when you're prepped for class, you know, like, because anything could come up. And so, on the one hand, it's easier. My colleagues at Biola outside the Honors College think, like, so you don't ever write lectures or have, like, lesson plans or basically anything. Like, you don't write a syllabus. It's not clear what you do. You just, like, go to rooms and talk about books. And I think, like, I understand how it looks like that. It's very hard to prep for a class and know that you're prepped. We bank a lot on the opening question. The opening question is it's a literal question. You start class with like maybe 1 minute of pep rally, like, woo, that was a great book, wasn't it? Who doesn't love David Hume? Wah! And then you ask a question, and it's a question that doesn't have an obvious answer, right? So you can't ask a yes or no question, especially if it's a question that is like, well, I understand what that means. But it suggests a direction, and it's got enough traction that students have some idea how to go about it. An opening question has to be something that implies a project that we're about to undertake together. And then ideally, an opening question should be motivating. So let me just work through that briefly. Motivating means like you've noticed something in the text, it's interesting to you, and you think it will be interesting to students if you propose it to them. That may not be immediately obvious, because prior to framing that opening question that poses a project, you need to first make a decision about what's the most important thing going on in the text. So you decide that, but then you don't ask that. So for instance, you read Galatians and think, oh, clearly the definition of faith is the main thing going on here. And the most straightforward opening question would be, what is faith? But what is faith is a definitional question, which is rarely motivating in itself. So you need to instead find a telling detail or an interesting way of putting things that's in the text that if the students that will be interesting to the students, and when they start pulling on it, it'll lead them inevitably to the real underlying question, is which is to understand faith. So in Galatians, it's something like, sometimes this is, we use the word weird for this. In Galatians, it would be like, what is the weirdest thing Paul does in Galatians? Like, remember that time where he says, faith and works are like these two mountains that are really these two women? That's weird. Like, let's ask about that. So you end up asking a Sarah and Hagar question, and students think like, man, I thought we were going to do theology, but instead we're doing like a relatively obscure woman from the Old Testament. You can't really call Sarah obscure, but Hagar's kind of out there, side character, right? Not the plot doesn't go out and follow her. So you form some kind of question about the relation of Sarah to Hagar, or how their relation to Abraham or something like that. And it's clear what students are supposed to do with that. And they start talking about it. Next thing you know, maybe an hour in, if everything goes perfectly, they'll say, yeah, but what is faith? And then you're like, yes, they walked right into my trap. Like, to answer the question about Hagar or the two mountains, they're going to have to decide what faith is. And they're doing it on their way to answering this question I just asked. In Dante's Divine Comedy, you could ask about Beatrice, because a lot comes down to sorting out, like, who is Beatrice and what is the meaning of the figure of Beatrice? But it's probably better to ask about Lucy or somebody. It's probably better to ask about a minor character, which frankly a student could have missed. But if you start trying to figure out what the deal is with Lucy, you have to connect her to a hierarchy at the top of which is Beatrice, and then you start talking about that. And all of this is to get into the actual structure of what's going on in Dante. The last two weeks I've taught Dante's Inferno, and I wanted to ask about the structure of hell. I think that the way Dante lays out the nature of the sins and the nature of their punishments in the Inferno is arguably one of the main things going on in that book. And it's all clearly explained in Canto 11 when it stinks so bad they have to take a break to get used to the smell. And while they're sitting there getting acclimated, Dante says, why is everything so bad in lower hell that I cannot see from here? And Virgil says, oh, well, it's all in the philosopher, in his ethics. It's all in Nicomachean Ethics. So let me explain that for you really quickly. It's a great section because for our sophomores, they read Nick Ethics as freshmen almost exactly a year ago. And so in order to understand the structure of hell, they've got to pull out of deep recall what they know about Aristotle's Nick Ethics. And some of it's given to them there on the page. So it's a nice little thing. But I don't just ask what's the structure of hell, and I don't just ask how does Aristotle's Nick Ethics give us the layout of hell. I instead go downstream a little bit from that and ask, why are the sins below Geryon the most grave? Now, even a good reader could miss Geryon on a quick romp through the Inferno. He's that weird flying monster. He doesn't have wings, though. He swims through the darkness. He comes up from nether hell, and the chopper lifts them down from the ledge of, is it the Violent there? From there down into the circles of fraud. And Dante describes him with way too much detail. There's all this detail. Once you find Geryon in Canto 17, the middle page of the Inferno, the exact center of the 34 cantos. Once you find him there, you realize, oh, he's got three parts. He's got a head that looks like a just man. He's got a body that's all covered with these weird circular designs. He's got these bear claws kind of coming off the body. Then he's got this long stinger tail that hangs off into the abyss. So like, well, that's a lot of description for a one-off monster, who, by the way, doesn't look anything like that in classical mythology. Hercules steals Geryon's cattle. It's one of his tasks. But Geryon's just a three-headed dude in classical mythology. Dante takes the name, gives you this long, weird description of who Geryon is, and then even gives you plenty of time for about how he perches on the side of the ledge and hangs his lower body off so his tail's drifting into the bottom. So let me get this straight. He's got the face of a just man, but he's only halfway on that upper ledge, and his bottom half goes down into the section of treachery. He kind of is a representation of fraud and treachery, right, in his tripartiteness, and he is kind of a little microcosm of hell in its tripartness, because hell is divided into these three zones. And students will kind of, they'll eventually pick up on that. I'm dying to say it. I'm dying to explain it to them just like I just explained it. I could write a paper on this, I feel like. But instead, I just keep asking them, what's the deal with Geryon? And maybe I don't have to ask them, because maybe, one, I did five sessions on this, 5 3-hour sessions. I started them exactly the same, and I got to watch the question go different ways with the five different groups based on their group personality. In one of them, it went just like a dream. Like, it was nearly that ideal class where I just asked the opening question and they discussed it. And one of them started going, wait, I think he's got three parts just like hell does. And I'm like, yes, we're there. And then in every class also, they all ended up going back to Canto 11, where Virgil says to Dante, don't you know this is all laid out according to the Nick ethics? It really worked. I will now use that question from now on. Like, that's my Inferno part two question. So that's an opening question. And I also tried to elevate the discourse a little bit. I didn't say which sins are worse. I said which ones are the most grave. It's just a little tweak of a word. It's a little richer vocabulary than just bad. It sounds like gravity. It sounds like death. There's just several things going on in there that a student could pick up on. Only one of the five groups did pick up on what's all going on in the word grave, but it was there. It was there for them. Well, that's the opening question. I can say more about opening questions. It only works, obviously, in some social settings. If you're doing like a book discussion group and you're more of a peer leader, you do have to sort of like in some way signal that you're the person in charge if you're going to be the one that's going to ask an opening question that's respected. We don't have to work for that because we're like college professors leading young college students, so it's built in to the system. But if you're leading peers, you know what it's like when you're just trying to discuss with friends what's going on in a book, but someone asks like, excuse me, but who made you boss? Like, oh, I'm sorry. I just wanted the discussion to go well. After that, there's follow-up questions, and follow-up questions have a number of forms, but most of them are about when a student cites a text and reads it and gets something out of it but leaves 90% of what's in it on the page, then you can just follow up like, wait, why did he say that? What was that part about? Right? These are short questions that kind of get you further into the text. And I feel like I'm prepped for class if I have an opening question I trust and about 10 follow-up questions written down. It's important to write them down because in the moment, you've got a little string around your finger reminding you to ask questions instead of making statements. You know, like, remember, don't forget that. And then the question that's going to come out of your mouth is going to be like, what do you all think? Which is just not enough question to do any lifting, right? So knowing I'm going to at some point ask, what do you all think, or what's everybody think about that, I write down 10 better shaped questions. And then I've also somewhere got a short list of the form that a question ought to take. Like sometimes I'll ask, if that's the answer, what was the question? It's just kind of a simple little, you know, judo trick to get people to kind of surface their intuitions about a text. So I feel prepped if I got an opening question and 10 follow-up questions, and then I know that I may not use those 10 follow-up questions because really good, well-framed questions might occur to me in the moment. But I need my 10 as a safety net in case they don't. So, yeah. All right, well, I have more that I could say about that, but I want to make sure to leave time for Q&A that might make it more appropriate to your own settings. Yeah.
So these students come expecting to do this, they want to do this.
Yeah.
Some of us teach high school age students where maybe they're not expecting that or desiring it. Are there ways that you prompt conversation when there's a lull?
Yeah, well, you look for signs of life. ideally you want all 16 people participating, but you've got temperamental differences. Some people are verbal processors, some people are shy. We're not trying to change anyone's personality, but we are trying to get everyone to participate. You're going to want to lean on the brighter lights who are like showing some signs of interest in the assigned text, or the verbal processors, and sometimes those are the same, and other times they're not. Right? So someone's always got an answer for everything and is ready to go and get thinking out loud. and maybe it's not even objectively helpful, but it is helpful in that they are doing the class's labor of getting someone going. Sometimes those people are so unhelpful, you have to intentionally ask harder and harder questions to shut them down, because they're just like, they're not just outer processors, they're glib, and they think they've got everything sorted all. So you just, I had one session where I was like in a duel with this guy, and I just couldn't get him to quit. Sometimes you just say, you're answering every question. Don't do that for a while, you know? Other times you just finally ask a question that's so difficult, they're like, what? What do you mean? Right? Like, here's the deal. You can have eternal life, but you have to be me. Do you want it? What? I don't, is that a trick? What? Why are you asking that? To shut you up. Right? Yeah. So that's one thing. Yeah, I admit we're in an honors program. We're intentionally bringing in students. We're putting in a bunch of time on the front end to motivate them, cool upperclassmen, telling them how to become like them someday.
Would you ever just call on somebody just to get the ball rolling?
I would, but it's pretty desperate. I haven't taught high school for a long time, so I don't remember how that works motivationally. But it is largely a motivational question at that point. You know, like, I want to get at the truth. I think I can do it through this book. So some of it's temperamental. This is kind of a dodge of an answer, but like, of the 16 people on the faculty, I'm on the high end for preparation and knowledge of a text. I'm somewhere in the middle for general motivational kind of like catching people's attention. And I'm on the low end for being like charming and affirming. It's like, I just don't radiate joy, acceptance, and the thrill of being in company. I'm a high-performing introvert, but at heart, I'm an introvert. And so if things go wrong, I can't turn on the class. If I turn on the class, it's like a stand-up comedian yelling at the audience, why aren't you laughing? You know, like, well, I don't know why they're not laughing, but they're not going to laugh now that you're yelling at them. So I've got that situation. Everything goes fine. As long as, now I've got colleagues who are like super friendly and joyfully radiant, and they can turn on a class and just mock them to their faces, like, you losers are leaving me hanging here. Like, I asked a good question, and what's your problem? Like, they laugh and go, ah, you're right. Tell us off. And then they just join right in. If I did that, that would be it. It'd be over. A year later, they'd still be talking about it. Like, I don't know, Sanders got mad at us. I don't know why. Like, yeah, but Janelle, she can get away with that, you know. So it really is a motivational question. Yeah.
Most of at Mars Hill, we're once a week, and we have an hour for class. Mm. In that limited amount of time, I mean, obviously this is credit, but it takes space and time and leisure.
Yeah.
How can we maximize the minimal exposure to the
evidence? Yeah. Good question. So, I mean, shorter text, if you've got an assigned text that you're working with, is that the context? Like, they've shown up having read something?
There's all kinds of different teachers here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of ways you can kind of increase the odds or make it, you know, get to the results faster. You can, if you've got an authority situation, like you're in charge and people expect you to be in charge, you can name a focus text. Right, like we're going to look at this paragraph, and you can, you know, zero in on a key term there that you know is going to be resonant and radiant and kind of draw other things to it. But you can like go out of your way to do that. Socratic teaching, we're really committed to 3 hours, but that takes a certain kind of. There's just even a kind of physical conditioning of being able to endure 3 hours of direct inquiry. We've got a particularly kind of radical version of it, you know, in some ways, but it's the same as all good teaching. Like every teacher in almost every teacher in almost every context is deciding between how do I deliver the amount of content I want to cover and also engineer moments of discovery, because I can deliver all the content, but if there's no discovery, it matters less to them, right? I just have to count on it being like true and seeming important enough that they'll retain it. And then, you know, there are empirical tests of how much people retain, and it's like 20% or something like that. So you engineer little moments of discovery. We're just kind of radical on the moments of discovery thing, but clearly they're still engineered. It's not just free range what did you get out of Dante kind of stuff. So you can do a focus text. You can load more into the opening question. If you can do the opening question model, you can ask something like, why is this character wrong about X? Right? So there's a value judgment and a shape built into it. Students and participants are free to question the value judgment you built into it. In fact, sometimes if you know they're going to be like that, you can build in a contradiction on purpose that they, you know, as soon as you ask it, they'll just perversely attack the question. But if you wanted them to, then it was kind of a chess move, right? You're like, you're ahead of them. Right? But those are ways of kind of still having it be moments of discovery enough to be truly Socratic, but a quicker burn. Yeah. Somewhere down that line is like, it's just fake Socratic. You're really lecturing, but you're doing it with a lot of question marks, right? And that's, it's probably more honest to just lecture better instead of make it seem like it's going to be a discussion. But you can kind of round off the edges and cut corners on the discussion and still have it be truly a group inquiry. That's what matters. You got to keep your eye on the ball. Like, we're trying to get to a truth. We think the text will help us, and I'm going to help proctor us to get there.
And you would say that the primary difference would be the lecturer being the primary source of the information versus the lecturer presenting a text, which is our primary source of information.
Yeah. Yep. So in the Great Books tradition, it's always advertised as, would you rather just study with, you know, a dozen currently living professors of, you know, mid-level intellect for the professorial class? Or do you want to study with Plato and Aristotle? And the promise of the Great Books is like, we're actually studying with the best. We also have qualified faculty to lead you in that, but the lessons are from texts that all of us are putting ourselves under. Yeah.
Yeah. How much preliminary work do you do? So say you're going to do the Republic. How much do you tell them who Plato is, what the book's about, and how much do you just throw them in cold?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. And that's also a question about sort of how much time do you have. Like, we got this 4-year commitment, and they're in the business of growing as knowledgeable people. We do very little. So we leave this squishy on purpose at our final. We do an oral final exam. And they fill out a piece of paper before they come into the 30-minute, two professors on one student oral final exam. One of the questions on it is, did you seek out relevant background information of a factual nature on each author? And so we try to get them to do that. Like, we could have codified this a long time ago. We could make a web page with 3 pages, you know, with 1,500 words of what we want them to know about an author, and no more. Because that turns out to be the hard part. How do they get a little bit of background orientation to an author, but not interpretive guidance? So we have to tell students, like, don't read the introduction. Some of the introductions in some of our books are good, and some of them they're bad, and some of them they don't matter, and some they're like, they've got an angle. So that's always, we've left that as a point of verbal negotiation every semester with every student. This goes on for the first couple of years. Like, well, did you seek out relevant background information? So, well, I wasn't sure what you meant by that. Good, yeah.
Basically not a lot of prep. Let's just get right into the text.
Right into the text. That's part of our Great Books ideology is the voice of this author in translation into our language can reach us and get us to see things. Yeah. It's been really hard to hire historians. Because historians have this secret knowledge, which is usually right, about, like, this makes sense in a certain context, which I know about and can tell you. I mean, like, sorry, that's cool, but, like, we're doing great books, and we actually think in the year 2024, 18-year-olds in Southern California can start reading The Republic and figure out what's going on. Yeah. 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 It does. Yeah, it takes some maturity. I'm not an expert in child development, but there are certain, you know, cognitive moves you're not it's not relevant to expect from really young children. I don't think I've done anything very Socratic with anyone younger than middle school, and even middle school was a stretch. I have a cartooning background, so I don't draw very good pictures to look at, but like I can diagram things. I have a really clear memory of a hour-long conversation on the Odyssey that was going bad, not getting anywhere, and I ended up drawing I drew a Cyclops with an Elvis hairdo, and somehow that was it. Like, that drew them in. Like, Cyclops with a pompadour just turned the whole class, and I thought, like, okay, I don't know why. I'm not even sure this is good, but it works, and today that's enough, yeah. No, when I teach at church, I teach a three-minute lesson to the first through fifth graders once a month. It can be 3 to 5, but if you think about the attention span of the first graders, that means 3. And I'm not even very good working the crowd for feedback. Like, some of the other really good elementary school teachers in there are like, what'd you do this weekend? I cannot go open mic with first through fifth graders. Like, I have no idea what to do with the things they say, you know? And it just gets loud so fast. So I resort to things like visual aids, you know, compelling immediate ideas. I actually got in trouble, not in trouble exactly, but last month I was teaching about God being sovereign, and I said, well, that means he can't make anything that overwhelms him. Like, he makes everything. It's this one doctrinal point. He's a creator and sovereign. So I tried to connect the two. But I started by saying, like, man, one time I dug a hole in my backyard so big, you couldn't even find me. Like, people would come out in the backyard and say, where's Fred? And, like, because I dug a hole deeper than I am tall. And, like, when I looked up from it, it towered up around me. Like, God doesn't make anything that towers up around him or is out of his control or can challenge him. And, they got that. And then I did some more doctrinal things with it in my remaining time. But I, like, made an immediate, you know, illustration kind of impact on him. The trouble is I started getting texts from church members whose kids were digging holes in their yards. but I had clearly explained that I got permission from myself to do this to my yard. And one actually was digging by the gas meter. So they got another lesson about, like, we have to call and see about gas lines. Yeah. But if Socratic education is possible at younger ages, I'm not aware of what that would be. Maybe one-on-one, but you got to really be good with kids at that point, and I don't have that kind of practice. Yeah, they move so fast, you know, and these instinctive connections that it's hard to track. Yeah.
Okay, so two questions. First, I know you mentioned at the Honors College you kind of cap it at 19 students.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Well, let me do the second one first. Yeah, it's a circle, and we usually have a whiteboard, and that's basically it. You know, when we had to do Zoom for a while during the pandemic, it was okay. Our kind of education worked pretty well for students confined to their childhood bedrooms. I mean, it was making the best of a bad situation, but at least you could say, like, well, life is bad right now, but for 3 hours this afternoon, I get to talk about Pride and Prejudice with people I know well. And so that was a bright spot in the day. But somehow that Brady Bunch grid was just a disaster. You know, it's a marvel of technology, and I never want to do it again. I understand there's distance learning, so you might do that. But it turns out the circle is just, you know, very, that's our technology, a circle of chairs. Yeah. And we do have a board, and you can use the board. You can kind of do a Socratic dance with the whiteboard, capturing things students say and writing it up there, you know, so that when someone says the right thing and everyone ignores them, you know, like, put it up there and say, what about what Miss Kim said a minute ago, you know?
Do the students use it at all?
They use it sometimes. Now and then they overuse and you got to call them down from it. Yeah, yeah. Or they think this diagram is going to work and you know from long, hard experience, like, that diagram is not going to work. Or they do a diagram bad, like, okay, the x-axis is never okay. Just let me coach you on the diagram a little bit. Yeah. If you do this with larger groups, you have to make a couple compromises. If you got like 30 students, first of all, you're not in a circle, because a circle that large, you can't see each other. Turns out there's this tiny amount of information we're actually looking for, right? Like, I'm ignoring everybody's feet. They're sticking right out there in the middle if we don't have a table. Like, oh, all these feet, so many toes. 160 toes. but I'm only looking for this information, you know, a little bit of body language, but I have to coach the tall guys, like, you can't slouch. Like, if you slouch in class, small girls can get away with it, but tall, slouching basketball players just put us all to sleep, like, just the gesture they're making. Just, like, I'm sorry it's unfair, but you got to sit down. Yeah, with a group of 30 or so, you can do some, I don't think it's real Socratic, and especially in the sense that you can't, everybody can't be involved. There's just no way for everyone to talk. A group of 16, everyone can talk at some level. Now, you're still going to have that moment where these three are the main interlocutors, and then that'll shift. One person drops out, another joins in, then a question will come up, and it'll bounce around. We're not all taking turns on every question. But with 30, there's nothing like that. So you might get some interaction between people where you mediate it by saying, you know, well, this view is that, God can make a rock so big he can't move it. I shouldn't pick a bad example like that. But that view, yeah. Sometimes I teach the Federalist Papers, using a surprising current example. I'll ask students, should California continue to be one state or should it be five? It's totally not in the text, obviously. But in order to answer it, everyone's motivated by it immediately. And as soon as they start arguing about it, they're surfacing all the questions about federalism and levels of political organization. And so you might do like, raise your hands if you've got five different states. And so you get hands, and you can kind of work that, you know, and get a dialogue going. But you pretty much have to shout it out from the front. If the 30 people in the class happen to include some very articulate speakers who are also loud enough to broadcast, then they might be able to speak for themselves. But that's where all these little imponderables come in, right? Like, oh, someone just made a good point, but they kind of mumble. That's where we are. Everyone's who they are, and you work with who you've got. Yeah.
We have time for one more question, and I'm going to ask it.
Okay.
Does any of this translate? I know you say you lead small groups in your church. Does any of this translate to that context, and if so, how?
Yeah, it does translate to that context. So we probably got 10 to 15 people that show up in our small group. And we discuss the sermon. We meet later on Sunday and we discuss the sermon. And there's kind of the balance of like, we're really discussing the text of Scripture through the sermon. And so there's a privileged interpreter who kind of declared it in a certain way. And we don't want to pick at him and say like he got the text wrong, unless he like objectively got the text wrong and we need to say something about that. But it's pretty rare. It's just like, I wonder why he picked that element and went with that. So we do that in the form of questions. We're not usually driving towards a further insight into the sermon. We're driving towards individual application because we're trying to carry through the work of the preaching. We're trying to serve the word by carrying through the work of the preaching into personal application that just can't be done from the front of the room. And so the values there are much more getting everybody to speak, right? In an academic classroom, I don't need everyone to speak in the sense of that's crucial for their development, not in any one session. Long term, I want to help people become more articulate. But in the small group, it's pretty crucial that everyone is able to articulate the way the point of the sermon influences their life. So sometimes that will be a question that we all go around and do. So if it was something about, if the sermon was about the power of the Word of God, you know, we might talk about, it's early in the year, the church is recommending a Bible reading program and or a memory program. But I know everyone, I don't know if this is just modern culture or if it's a Southern California thing, but I know everyone's got their own practices they're cultivating. Right? So what are you doing? And we'll go around and everyone will share their thing. So that's much more of the dynamic. But the question about the guiding text and the key interpreter of it still can have very much the same shape. I'm not going to articulate a puzzle, you know, in the same way. I'm not going to ask about Garion. Yeah, in a small group.